تقيا مقيما شمالا جنوبا.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
At this point, it is fair to ask, why China? The superficial answer is that Ibn Battuta had obviously determined to travel as widely as he possibly could. From the Malabar coast of India, China was almost as distant as Tangier, where he had started his traveling 20 years earlier. His first attempt to get to China was at the head of a royal embassy, which would have been a magnificent way to see the country. Now he was merely a well-traveled, politically savvy, well-connected Qadi who offered potential patrons a greater knowledge of the world and a better grasp of how it worked than most of his peers. He had no particular need to go to China. Why not pack up his sandals and go home? Yet China was a tremendous attraction for travelers from the 10th to the 13th century, mutually reinforcing prosperity in the Islamic lands under the Abbasids, and in China under the Song dynasties, boosted Arab trade to heady heights. The Mongol Yuan dynasty took China in 1279, and despite the Mongol devastations within Dar al-Islam, the maritime trade was little affected. Omani and other traders, as before, continued their arduous 18-month voyages from the Arabian Gulf to Quanzhou. Even though the Yuan never embraced Islam, unlike other Mongol dynasties that controlled Persia and Central Asia, they tended to trust Muslims more than they trusted their Chinese subjects. They esteemed Muslims as men of their word, as merchants who did not err because of intoxication, and respected them as men of Quran. The Yuan open door policies filled their bureaucracy with Muslims of all origins, not to mention a few Westerners like Niccolo Polo and his son Marco. Thus, Ibn Battuta may have been lured towards China for two of the same reasons he had been lured to India: the prospect of employment and a persistent memory of the pious Alexandrian Burhan al-Din, who two decades earlier had predicted that Ibn Battuta would one day visit China and greet his brother of the same name. Ibn Battuta's account of his time in China is much briefer than that of the 5,700-kilometer voyage that took him there by way of Burma and Sumatra. This is surprising in light of the rich detail lavished earlier in the Rihla on every corner of the Indian subcontinent that the traveler could reach. Ibn Battuta's scanty account of China is one of the greatest riddles of the Rihla. On the whole, Ibn Battuta seems to have enjoyed China less than any other place he had so far visited. Perhaps he was simply road weary. Ibn Battuta recalled,
"China, for all its magnificence, did not please me. When I left my lodging, I saw many offensive things which distressed me so much that I stayed at home and went out only when it was necessary. When I saw Muslims, it was as though I had met my family and my relatives."
After less than a year, rebellion broke out in China and Ibn Battuta set sail. By this point in his travels, the flush of youthful discovery and the prospects of success just over the horizon seemed to have left Ibn Battuta, or perhaps, by this point, in his recounting, he was growing weary of dictating to his scribe, Ibn Juzay. Among the remaining pages of Ibn Battuta's Rihla is one of his most harrowing accounts. It was late spring in 1348 in Aleppo, where Ibn Battuta learned that at Gaza, the plague had broken out and the number of deaths reached over 1,000 a day. Although his numbers were hardly official statistics, his impressions of the Black Death are now certainly first-hand.
"I went to Horns and found that the plague had already struck there. About 300 persons died on the day of my arrival. I went to Damascus and arrived on a Thursday. The people had been fasting for 3 days. The number of deaths among them had risen to 2,400 a day. Then we went to Gaza and found most of it deserted because of the number that had died. The Qadi told me that the number of deaths had risen to 1,100 a day. Then I went to Cairo and was told during the plague the number of deaths rose to 21,000 a day. I found that all the shuyukh I had known were dead. May Allah Most High have mercy upon them."
He reported only on the areas he visited, and that briefly. Today we know that the plague was as great a pandemic in Dar al-Islam as it was in Europe. Onwards to Makkatul Mukarramah for his intended fourth Hajj. Ibn Battuta remained in Mecca from the month of Ramadan through the month of Hajj, pledging to visit his old and ailing mother
and Tangier soon after. Further west, the tribes of Ifriqiya were once more besieging Tunis. The once strong leader in the region, Abu al-Hassan, seized the central Maghrib, then sent an expedition to take Gibraltar. Emboldened by its success, he sent another into Spain to try and stop and drive back the waves of Christian knights out of Castile. But he lost much of his army at the Battle of Rio Salado, an event that augured the last scene on the last act of Islam's presence in southwestern Spain and Portugal. Then, alas, in Taza, near Fez, he learned that death knocked on his mother's door before he had been able to. She had died of the plague that he had escaped. So though the great traveler had returned home, he was not yet done traveling. There were two more significant journeys to make, one to the north and one to the south. In contrast to his China narrative, his descriptions of Al-Andalus are no less copious and rich than the rest of the Rihla. For anyone who has been to southern Spain, the scenery has been changed only in that the tracks he walked are now mostly paved roads, and that in the towns, satellite dishes clutter what were the unbroken roofscapes of red tile. Ibn Battuta was as charmed with Granada as visitors are today. It was the time of Yusuf I, who was then building Alhambra, though Ibn Battuta does not mention it. He does mention one item, almost in passing, that speaks again of the extraordinary mobility of the population of Dar al-Islam in the early 14th century.
There was a company of Persians in Granada who have made their home there because of its resemblance to their native lands. One is from Samarkand, another from Tabriz, a third from Konya, two from Khorasan, two from India, and so on.
He also met a young man, a distinguished poet who was mesmerized by the places and people Ibn Battuta had seen. His name was Muhammad Ibn Juzay, and he wrote down a number of the traveler's stories sketchily and spontaneously. The two would meet again in Fez some 5 years later, when Ibn Juzay would be commissioned to record the full extent of Ibn Battuta's travels. In the Rihla, Ibn Juzay notes as an aside, "In that garden, Sheikh Abu Abdullah delighted us with the story of his travels. Then, Sheikh Abu Abdullah returned to Fez by way of Rabat and Marrakesh, where he noted
magnificent mosques, like the principal mosque, known as the Mosque of the Booksellers. It has a wonderful and awe-inspiring minaret, which I climbed and from which the whole town can be seen.
Today, we can't climb that minaret, but we can certainly agree on its beauty." When he got back to Morocco, political conditions were stable and Sultan Abu Inan was building the finest madrasa Fez had ever known. By now, Ibn Battuta had traversed the entirety of Dar al-Islam, except the part almost closest to his home, but which, because of the difficulty of getting there, was, in practical terms, further away than all the rest. On the first day of the month of Muharram in early 1352, Ibn Battuta set out again. Where does he travel to? What are his experiences? Find out in segment 16 of this series.